and you're tuned to WUHY FM in Philadelphia. The Jewish Publication Society recently published the third and final volume of its new translation of the Old Testament. Novelist Chaim Potok played a key role in this translation, and in June he joined us on Fresh Air to discuss the language and meaning of this text. We asked if he could speak with us again on Fresh Air, this time to do comparative readings and explanations of the King James translation, the 1917 Jewish Publication Society translation, and this new translation, and I'm glad to say that he's with us in the studio now, and we'll get to hear how dramatically different this new translation is. This is the first translation since 2,200 years ago to go back to the original Hebrew text. The King James Version, published in 1611, was largely based on the Latin translation of the Old Testament. Other versions were basically rewrites of the King James Version. The Jewish Publication Society felt that the King James translation was frequently inaccurate, and they commissioned a panel of Jewish scholars to return to the Hebrew source to translate it into modern English. The Society felt that the archaic English constructions of previous translations made the Old Testament difficult and unsatisfying for readers today. This third and final volume that was recently published contains the chapters known collectively as the Writings, and this includes the Psalms, the Proverbs, Job, the Song of Songs, Lamentations, and Ecclesiastes. Chaim Potok served as secretary of the Writings Committee for the past 16 years. He's best known as a novelist, and his books include The Chosen, The Promise, My Name is Asher Lev, and The Book of Lights. A recent nonfiction book of his is called Wanderings, A History of the Jews. He's also an ordained conservative rabbi. We'll be opening up the phones a little later after he's done some of these comparative readings and inviting you to call with any reactions you have to the translation or any questions you'd like to ask him about the process of translating the Old Testament. Welcome back to Fresh Air, and I'm really glad you could be with us.
It's good to be here.
Certainly a very exciting subject. You want to just give us an overview of the three texts that you'll be quoting from?
The King James was a translation commissioned by King James of England, published in 1611. It draws from many previous translations, the Tyndale, and the Wycliffe, and the Bishop's Bible, and the Coverdale Bible. About 50 scholars worked on the translation. They were scholars of Latin, of Greek, and I'm pretty certain that there were among them very fine scholars of Hebrew. They knew the important languages into which the Bible had been translated up until that point. And what they produced was less a literal translation of the Bible than a translation that resonated with what they thought biblical passages really meant. Those resonances have passed into the English language and have become part of our heritage. We use those resonances, whether we're aware of them or not. I personally have a very profound reverence for the King James Bible. Even when it's wrong, it's exquisite. And there's value in that special kind of exquisiteness in the language that it uses. And it was with enormous hesitation and considerable misgivings that I saw some of the passages of the King James fall by the wayside as we worked on our translation. But our charge was to produce a translation that could be read by a contemporary American or Englishman, anyone knowing the English language. And our charge was, wherever necessary, to break with the tradition of what we generally would call Bible English, or biblish, as some people put it. I thought that what I might do today is read a number of passages that are known to most people, and one or two that might not be too well known. And it will become clear in the reading how revolutionary this new translation is. Most of the changes are based upon new findings in frontier Bible scholarship. Established findings, many of these findings in the last 30, 40, 50 years, a lot of them having to do with fragments of literary material that were dug up out of the earth of the Middle East, of Mesopotamia, which is now Iraq, areas in Syria, areas in Lebanon, and so on and so forth. We have an altogether different understanding of the nature of the biblical world today from the understanding that was had even as recently as a generation or so ago. I thought I would read the very first section of the book of Genesis. Then I want to read the Ten Commandments. Then I'd like to read that magnificent passage in Isaiah about beating swords into plowshares, something rather appropriate for these grim moments that we're living through today. And then maybe some other passages that people will readily recognize. Here is the book of Genesis. The opening cadences in the King James translation, the creation story. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. And the earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters. And God said, "Let there be light." And there was light. And God saw the light, that it was good. And God divided the light from the darkness. And God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. And the evening and the morning were the first day. The King James. In 1917, the Jewish Publication Society of America published its translation of the Bible into English. The people who worked on this translation had my reverence for the King James. They loved it. And though their task was to utilize new scholarship to alter whatever had to be altered, for the most part, they retained the cadences of the King James. And this is how that old Jewish Publication Society, OJPS it is now reverently called, this is how it renders the passage I just read to you from the King James. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. Now the earth was unformed and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God hovered over the face of the waters. And God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. And God saw the light, that it was good. And God divided the light from the darkness. And God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. And there was evening, and there was morning, one day. There are very few changes from the King James. Very few between the King James and what we now call the OJPS. The changes in the new text are considerable. And after I'm done reading the new text, I'd like to stop and point out the reasons for some of the changes. Here is the new translation of the beginning of the creation story. When God began to create the heaven and the earth being unformed and void with darkness over the surface of the deep and a wind from God sweeping over the water, God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. God saw how good the light was, and God separated the light from the darkness. God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. And there was evening, and there was morning, a first day. The new translation is very close to the meaning of the original Hebrew. The Hebrew is not, "In the beginning God created." It is, "When God began to create the heaven and the earth." But it might be "in the beginning," and so in a footnote, the translators tell us, or, that is to say, there's another way of reading this which we recognize as being part of the biblical tradition, the translation tradition. We prefer the new rendering, but we acknowledge the possibility of the old one. And so you have in a footnote or open quote, "In the beginning God created," close quote. However, as we continue, there is a very radical difference. And here there was no compromising because an error had been made in the King James. And the error has to do with the translation of the Hebrew word ruach, which was translated in the King James and in the OJPS as the Spirit of God. and which is translated in the new translation, the new JPS, NJPS as we call it, and a wind from God. Here you have a picture of the primeval chaos and enormous winds, mighty winds, sweeping across the primeval waters that precede creation, the void, the chaos. The notion of spirit simply doesn't exist in the Bible, nor does the notion of soul as we understand it today. Those are late notions in the development of our species. Soul is essentially a Greek idea. Spirit is very late, certainly not biblical in origin. Indeed, the word ruach could not possibly mean a spirit of God. And so what you have on the bottom of this, on the foot of this page in the translation, is the notation others, which means that the spirit of, which they note here, has been rejected by this translation. They note it because it is so much a part of the world in which we live that when people read this translation, they will be thrown off balance, as it were. And so the translators want us to know that they're aware of the biblical translation that preceded them, the tradition of that translation, that they're aware of the existence of the form, the Spirit of God, and that they are rejecting it. This is essentially the way this translation moves from the very beginning, from Genesis, all the way through to the end of the Bible. I must say that for people who really understand and love the King James, there's something jarring about this new English version. The tonalities seem to be a roar, far rawer than the beauty of the King James. And yet, this is the way we talk today. This is the kind of English we use today. And this is correct insofar as scholarship is concerned. And so what we tried to do here was blend today's English with the best way we could express that English with full knowledge of the scholarship that we have and with reverence toward what there was in the past, not to discard the past simply because it was past.
How did the Hebrew that it was originally written in compare to the Hebrew that was spoken at the time?
We have no idea.
Because like the King James type of English that we're familiar with is not a way that people speak now, but it's a way of, it's a formal way of writing that people have become accustomed to, particularly from writing of the past.
Yes, yeah. I heard recently somebody do Elizabethan English. I'm not altogether certain that I'm aware of the scholarship that he based the pronunciation on, but it's very close to the Irish pronunciation that we generally hear, heavy Irish pronunciation, or perhaps even Welsh, something along those lines. It is certainly not the English that we're familiar with today. It's not Cambridge English. We don't know what the original Hebrew sounded like. We have no way of knowing.
Okay. Should we do the Ten Commandments?
I thought we would do the Ten Commandments. The differences here are not radical except for one that clangs at you once you're aware of the implications of that tiny change. And here the difference already occurred in the old JPS translation. The Ten Commandments, familiar to all of us. Here it is. Here are the Ten Commandments in the King James Version. And God spake all these words, saying, I am the Lord thy God, which have brought thee out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. Thou shalt have no other gods before me. Thou shalt not make unto thee any graven image, or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that is in the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. Thou shalt not bow down thyself to them, nor serve them. For I, the Lord thy God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children unto the third and fourth generation of them that hate me, and showing mercy unto thousands of them that love me and keep my commandments. Thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain, for the Lord will not hold him guiltless that taketh his name in vain. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days shalt thou labor and do all thy work, but the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord thy God. In it thou shalt not do any work, thou, nor thy son, nor thy daughter, thy manservant, nor thy maidservant, nor thy cattle, nor thy stranger that is within thy gates. For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, the sea, and all that in them is, and rested the seventh day. Wherefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and hallowed it. Honor thy father and thy mother, that thy days may be long upon the land which the Lord God giveth thee. Thou shalt not kill. Thou shalt not commit adultery. Thou shalt not steal. Thou shalt not bear false witness against thy neighbor. Thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's house. Thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife, nor his manservant, nor his maidservant, nor his ox, nor his ass, nor anything that is thy neighbor. The Ten Commandments in the old JPS version. And God spoke all these words, saying, I am the Lord thy God, who brought thee out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. Thou shalt have no other gods before me. Thou shalt not make unto thee a graven image, nor any manner of likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that is in the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. Thou shalt not bow down unto them, nor serve them, for I, the Lord thy God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children unto the third and fourth generation of them that hate me, and showing mercy unto the thousandth generation of them that love me and keep my commandments. Thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain, for the Lord would not hold him guiltless that taketh his name in vain. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days shalt thou labor and do all thy work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath unto the Lord thy God. In it thou shalt not do any manner of work, thou, nor thy son, nor thy daughter, nor thy manservant, nor thy maidservant, nor thy cattle, nor thy stranger that is within thy gates. For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, the sea, and all that in them is, and rested on the seventh day. Wherefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and hallowed it. Honor thy father and thy mother, that thy days may be long upon the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee. Thou shalt not murder. Thou shalt not commit adultery. Thou shalt not steal. Thou shalt not bear false witness against thy neighbor. Thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's house. Thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife, nor his manservant, nor his maidservant, nor his ox, nor his ass, nor anything that is thy neighbor's. The crucial change here, clearly, is the commandment that says, thou shalt not murder. The King James incorrectly translated the Hebrew, thou shalt not kill. There is a fundamental difference, clearly, between thou shalt not kill and thou shalt not murder. And that correction was made in the OJPS translation.
What's the difference between kill and murder?
Murder is deliberate. Murder is pre-planned. You might very well justifiably kill in self-defense. It's very different, clearly, one from the other. The difference between the new JPS translation and the two that I've read are immediate. The language, the cadences. I, the Lord, am your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, the house of bondage. You shall have no other gods beside me. You shall not make for yourself a sculptured image or any likeness of what is in the heavens above or on the earth below or in the waters under the earth. You shall not bow down to them or serve them, for I, the Lord your God, am an impassioned God, as over against a jealous God, visiting the guilt of the fathers upon the children, upon the third and upon the fourth generation of those who reject me, but showing kindness to the thousandth generation of those who love me and keep my commandments. You shall not swear falsely by the name of the Lord your God, for the Lord will not clear one who swears falsely by his name. The previous translations had You shall not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain. Here it is, you shall not swear falsely. We continue with the Sabbath day. Remember the Sabbath day and keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath of the Lord your God. You shall not do any work, you, your son or daughter, your male or female slave, or your cattle, or the stranger who is within your settlements. For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth and sea, and all that is in them, and he rested on the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and hallowed it. Honor your father and your mother, that you may long endure on the land which the Lord your God is giving you. You shall not murder. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not steal. You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. You shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife, or his male or female slave, or his ox or his ass, or anything that is your neighbor's. The tonalities are different. The yous make it so much a part of the familiar world in which we live. The changes are subtle, the changes are stylistic, and yet they are quite revolutionary. It is a significant break with an enormously powerful tradition of Bible translation.
Substituting impassioned for jealous is, I think, really dramatic, because the image of the jealous God of the Old Testament is someone you don't mess with, because they're really jealous. And jealousy, it has terrible connotations. I mean, it's one of the most difficult emotions that we humans have to deal with. So impassioned doesn't have any of those connotations.
That's
right. Does it change the image of God in the Old Testament?
It does for me, yes. Clearly the concept of the jealous God comes to us from the King James. And clearly one of the effects of the new translation is to put that concept in altogether a different light.
We had talked a little bit about a month ago when you were here about how you chose not to try to use intentionally non-sexist language that wasn't an issue in this translation. Now, in a passage like "Thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife," which is "You shall not covet thy neighbor's wife," in this one, the Ten Commandments are obviously addressing themselves to men and not to women, because unless you're a lesbian, you wouldn't be coveting your neighbor's wife if you were a woman. If you see my point. So, how did you consider that? Is that
you mean?
That
it
matter?
Should have said to a woman, "Thou shalt not covet."
Well,
thy neighbor's husband.
Well, "thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's spouse,"
yes,
would apply to everyone. But if God's saying you shall not sleep with your neighbor's wife, he's only talking to men and lesbians and not to straight women who wouldn't be sleeping with their neighbor's wife.
There's no question that the ambience in which all of this was initially created was a patriarchal or male-dominated ambience. Generally, the Semitic ambience is that. So was the Greek ambience. I would suspect that most civilizations were that until fairly recently. There is this notion that once upon a time there were matriarchal civilizations, but we have no record of those civilizations. Written history is essentially the history of male-dominated civilizations. Therefore, I suppose the angle here is directed toward the male.
But your goal was to be true to that original text, and
yes,
where that original text,
yes,
recognized men and
that's
not
right,
women, you'd follow.
That's right.
That.
We would have to do that. The charge was to work only with what we call a Masoretic or traditional text, the given text, the text that was handed down, which made it very difficult for us, because the scholars on the committee know how to amend the text and change the difficult words, but we were not permitted to do that. The only time we altered a word was when the word we wanted to alter it to was very similar to the original, and we thought it gave us a better reading. Or we found the other word in one of the classical translations, like the Septuagint or the Vulgate. Otherwise, we did not alter the Hebrew text.
Now, another change, and this change happened first in the 1917 version, instead of "thou shalt not kill," it's "thou shalt not murder." And you were mentioning to me before that you think that, like a lot of pacifists, have used the thou shalt not kill in the Bible to justify pacifism. And I guess if it's murder and not kill, you can't really use that unless you're defining war as murder, in which case you could use it.
Yes, I think that the pacifist attitude comes first, then people look around for texts to justify the attitude. Clearly, the pacifist attitude is very deep and very fundamental among many, many people. But I have heard this text used, and this translation clearly indicates that it cannot be used unless one regards war simply as murder, in which case you can use the text.
Let me say that what we're talking about is the new Jewish Publication Society translation of the Old Testament, and my guest is Chaim Potok, who is best known as a novelist, but unbeknownst to many of his readers for the past 16 years, was serving as the chair of the committee of the third and final volume of this translation of the Old Testament. And for this translation, they went back to the original Hebrew and tried to be true to the meaning of that original Hebrew and to translate it into modern English. In about 10 minutes, we'll be opening up the telephones. This version is dramatically different than the biblical language we're used to. And I know you may have questions about the process of translating or the decisions that the scholars made. We'll be opening up the phones in just a few minutes, and you can phone in any questions or comments that you have. If you'd like to make a note of the phone number in the meantime, it's 923-2774. As a matter of fact, what you can do is call now, and we'll put you on hold for the next few minutes, and you can listen while you're on hold. And that way, when we're ready to open up the phones, you'll be on the line. So if you want to do that, you can call now at 923-2774. What's the next passage you want to compare for us?
I thought I would take another very well-known passage, a passage quite appropriate to this period of time, and show how very little was done to change it. This translation didn't simply come in and decide to change things willy-nilly. If what they found was acceptable and lovely, they left it. The translators left it the way it was. This is the very famous vision of Isaiah. King James. And it shall come to pass in the last days that the mountain of the Lord's house shall be established in the top of the mountains and shall be exalted above the hills, and all nations shall flow unto it. And many people shall go and say, Come ye, and let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob, and he will teach us of his ways, and we will walk in his paths. For out of Zion shall go forth the law, and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. And he shall judge among the nations, and shall rebuke many people. And they shall beat their swords into plowshares, and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war any more. What magnificent words, magnificent words. Here is how the old JPS translation rendered this passage from Isaiah. And it shall come to pass in the end of days that the mountain of the Lord's house shall be established as the top of the mountains, and shall be exalted above the hills, and all nations shall flow unto it. And many peoples shall go and say, Come ye, and let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob. And he will teach us of his ways, and we will walk in his paths. For out of Zion shall go forth the law and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. And he shall judge between the nations and shall decide for many peoples. And they shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war any more. Almost no changes. The changes are, I would say, negligible, a word here and there. Here is the new JPS translation of this extraordinary prophecy that we're all waiting to come true. In the days to come, The mount of the Lord's house shall stand firm above the mountains and tower above the hills, and all the nations shall gaze on it with joy. And the many peoples shall go and shall say, Come, let us go up to the mount of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob, that he may instruct us in his ways, and that we may walk in his paths. For instruction shall come forth from Zion, not the law, but instruction. And here we're told in a footnote that the word instruction really means oracles. The normal procedure of receiving oracles, which was part of the culture of the ancient world, that's what will come forth from Zion, the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. Thus he will judge among the nations and arbitrate for the many peoples, and they shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not take up sword against nation. They shall never again know war. The resonances of the last line are different from the resonances of the last line of the King James. Shall not know war anymore. They shall never again know war. But substantially, the translation is intact. I suspect that nobody really wanted to alter the English of the original, which is absolutely magnificent and which is correct. No need to alter it. There's something of the eternal about the cadences and the words of that particular passage, and so it's left virtually untouched.
It's curious that some passages were translated much more closely from the Hebrew than others were.
I think they worked with considerable care with regard to how much a passage was part of the warp and woof of our civilization. No one wants to disentangle the fiber of our civilization. And if it didn't have to be done with this particular translation, it wasn't done. The translation was left. And clearly in this instance, there was no need to do it.
Would you like to compare one more passage and then we'll take some phone calls?
This is a psalm. Well, let's do a proverb, which I think is brief and a bit humorous. And here we have a colloquialism that rounds out this proverb. Very well-known proverb, King James. The slothful hideth his hand in his bosom. It grieveth him to bring it again to his mouth. The image is not too clear to us, but it'll become clearer in the other translations. The sluggard is wiser in his own conceit than seven men that can render a reason. He that passeth by and meddleth with strife belonging not to him is like one that taketh a dog by the ears. Again, the images are not too clear, right?
Yes.
Yes. As a madman who casteth firebrands, arrows, and death, so is the man that deceiveth his neighbor and saith, or saith, depending upon how you pronounce that, am not I in sport? Very difficult to conceive of what it is that this proverb, section of proverb, is really trying to say. Here is how the old JPS rendered that same section. The sluggard burieth his hand in the dish, it wearieth him to bring it back to his mouth. Still not too clear. The sluggard is wiser in his own eyes than seven men that give wise answer. He that passeth by and meddleth with strife not his own is like one that taketh a dog by the ears. As a madman who casteth firebrands, arrows, and death, so is the man that deceiveth his neighbor and saith, Am not I in sport? Now let's see how the new JPS renders this. It's the same Hebrew, the same passage, and there are virtually no changes that have to be made of any radical nature other than the English style. The lazy man buries his hand in the bowl. He will not even bring it to his mouth. The lazy man thinks himself wiser than seven men who give good advice. A passerby who gets embroiled in someone else's quarrel is like one who seizes a dog by its ears. Now that's a vivid image. Like a madman scattering deadly firebrands, arrows, is one who cheats his fellow and says, "I was only joking." Now that's the way colloquialisms and ordinary language are utilized to clear up what is essentially in the Hebrew a pretty clear passage, but which the English language doesn't quite convey in earlier translations.
That's a very vivid illustration of that. If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Chaim Potok, and he's prepared for us comparisons between the 1611 King James publication of the Old Testament, the 1917 Jewish Publication Society translation that was based on that King James version, and the new Jewish Publication Society translation of the Old Testament, which went back to the original Hebrew text and translated it to modern English. Chaim Potok was the chair of the committee of scholars that did the third and final volume of this translation of the Old Testament, which was just published a few weeks ago. Well, this translation is very different from what we're used to, and I think you might have some questions about how it was done or some of the considerations that they made in choosing language or in trying to determine what the original meaning was, or you might have an opinion you'd like to share with us about how this new translation sounds. If you'd like to call us, our number is 923-2774. We're at area code 215, and once again, that's 923-2774. Let's take our first phone call. Hi, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Yes, I was wondering if Mr. Potok was familiar with the New English Bible, which came out, I believe, in the 40s, and who had whose editorial committee was contained Jewish scholars as well as others, and who tried to do exactly the same thing, and I believe succeeded very well, and went back to the original papyri and the original text, back to the original Hebrew, when they could get it. And I'm wondering, and also gives footnote credits to various witnesses and various other papyri than the one that's printed by the committee, and I was wondering if there couldn't be some kind of acknowledgement of that work too, which I welcome as much as I welcome this new Jewish Bible.
And do you want to comment on that?
Oh, yes. We used virtually all the really significant Bible translations as we went about doing our work on this translation. We use the Bible translation just mentioned. We use the Moffat. We use the King James. We use English Bible translations. I think we must have had more than a dozen translations open at the table, on the table as we work, plus the medieval commentaries and so on. The difference between what the translation that was just mentioned and the one that I'm referring to is, number one, this translation was sponsored by the Jewish community of the United States, and it is essentially an English rendering of the Hebrew Masoretic text, the given text, the traditional text, which we took it upon ourselves not to amend in any way at all. Previous Bible translations generally, of the modern period, are generally quite easy with regard to altering the text when they encounter difficulties.
Well, the whole point of this one was to not do that. The whole point was to do what you tried to do in yours.
Yes, and also that may and may not be true to some extent, but the fact of the matter is that since that Bible came out, an enormous world of new scholarship has opened up. We're talking now about 40 years of new scholarship, and this scholarship was also part of the New Jewish Publication Society translation of the Bible.
Yes. Thanks so much for your phone call.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye. Hi, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
Okay. I have a couple of questions about particular verses in the Psalms. My first question is about verse 14 in Psalm 17. And when I read the translation of it in the NJPS version, I was startled by the difference between that and the one I was familiar with. The King James translation is confirmed by the New American Bible, by the New English Bible, by the Grail translation of the Psalms. And your translation is quite different, and also the Good News Bible has a very different translation from either yours or the traditional one.
Do you have a question?
And I was wondering what the problem is in the Hebrew there, because none of the texts mentions any difficulty in the Hebrew.
Give us the
verse. In the NJPS translation, it's, "From men, O Lord, with your hand, from men whose share in life is fleeting, but as to your treasured ones, fill their bellies, their sons too shall be satisfied, and have something to leave over for their young." Now, if you check the King James, it's quite different, quite different. Do you have the King James there?
Yes.
I don't have it in front of me. I was just wondering, since you were secretary of the committee, whether or not you would have a memory of any difference.
Well, I don't have the proceedings or the notes in front of me. Give me the verse again.
Right, it's
I may be able to get it to you from
14,
the Hebrew.
Psalm 17.
Right, 17:14.
If maybe this is a question best saved for another time, if it's too specific to deal with now.
Okay.
Oh, I see what it is. No, this is not anything we can talk about now.
Okay. Sorry, but thanks for your call.
I do have one more question about a different psalm.
Yes.
And this is a more general question.
Yeah, and keep it brief, because we do want to get to as many callers as possible.
Okay, fine. In Psalm 147, verse 5, the verse is, "Great is our Lord." This is NJPS.
Well, what psalm is that?
Psalm 147.
Right.
Verse 5, "Great is our Lord and full of power. His wisdom is beyond reckoning." Now, as I understand from a note in a King James version that I have, that the Hebrew here is, "of his understanding, no number."
147, verse
5.
Right. I have it.
Right. "Of his understanding, no number." And all the translations that I know seem to skirt around that. And it seemed to me that the literal Hebrew there was much more descriptive of the meaning. And I wondered why you didn't use the literal Hebrew.
What did we use?
You have, "His wisdom is beyond reckoning." I think that the King James is his understanding.
Because that's what it means. It doesn't mean infinite, which is, I think, the way the King James reads it. Is that what it has? Infinite? Because I see that in the OJPS. It means exactly what the way it was translated.
Thanks for your phone call. We do want to get to as many calls as possible. Thank you for calling. If you're just joining us, Chaim Potok is my guest, and we're discussing the New Jewish Publication Society translation of the Bible. He was the chair of the committee that translated the Old Testament to modern English. Hi, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
Hello. I have two brief questions. The first one is, I believe this is before the new translation. In the Masoretic text, it says, "And God said, let the earth put forth grass, herb yielding seed, and fruit tree bearing fruit after its kind." Okay. The point is, it says, "And it shall be as meat unto you." I don't know if you're familiar with that. As a vegetarian, I look towards that as confirmation. Do you?
There is a tradition, you know, that man, in his primal state, was not a meat-eating creature.
Right.
And that part of the meat-eating aspect of man has to do with the fall and the casting out of the garden and so on. And people do indeed take that from the verse that you just
It says someplace, "And it shall be as meat unto you," and I don't see it here. Maybe that's...
Well, is that meant literally, like about steak?
M-E-A-T, yeah. No, but they simply mean like the meat of a fruit. You know, that's what they're talking about there.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, Right. Okay.
All right.
Well, look somewhere else for confirmation, I guess.
That's okay. Also, one other thing. I don't know if, as you were reviewing it, any type of Hasidic concepts ever came into this. But in the Bible, as I read it, it doesn't seem to be suggesting too much spiritually. Were there any changes made any place towards a more spiritual, you know, perspective?
Not by us if they weren't found in the Bible. There's such a marvelous quality of Israelite piety in the Bible that it wasn't necessary for us to impose outside spirits upon the Bible. What we had to do was find that quality of unique Israelite piety in the Bible, and that comes out in passages like the creation story, in sections like the Psalms, in the book of Job, and so on. What we tried to do was capture the tonalities of Israelite piety and not impose upon the Israelite world qualities from outside it.
Thanks so much for your phone call.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. If you have any questions about this translation, you can call us at 923-2774, and we're at area code 215. Hi, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
My question is this. John Boyce was the secretary of the company that translated the King James Version of the Bible. Some of his notes were discovered in the mid-1960s and published in a book called Translating for King James. This included facsimile pages of the notes of John Boyce, and I would like to ask if those notes were among the papers used in this new translation.
I'm sure that the scholars knew about those. The scholars who worked both, there were two committees that worked on the new JPS translation. One of the scholars has been working for years on a committee of Christian scholars that has been translating segments of the Bible. And this individual is quite well versed in that field, and I'm quite certain that he knew about it. The people who worked on the committee that I was secretary of, not chair,
Terry.
The people who worked on my committee were quite aware of the entire tradition of Bible translation from its inception until the modern period.
These notes, as I know, were not, they had lain unrecognized until the 60s and were discovered quite by accident. And that's one reason I asked the question.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for your call. Bye-bye. Hi, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
Yes, I have a question regarding the development of the Satan concept. I was doing some Bible research when I was in college, and I was looking at the period of the book of Job and was wondering at what point, perhaps in your research, you were able to find out the change from the adversary concept to more of Satan as the evil one.
It's a very slow transformation. The notion of Satan as evil, I think, is early medieval. The notion of Satan as adversary is pure biblical. The word Satan is someone who stands opposed to you. The Satan was like the the judge, advocate, general, somebody who was a kind of district attorney, someone whose job it was to bring problems in the world before God's presence, someone whose job it was to go about seeing what trouble there was and bringing that to the attention of God. He was the adversary with a capital A, and indeed, in the new translation, the new JPS translation, Satan in the book of Job is translated as adversary. There is nothing evil about Satan in the book of Job. His job is to be the adversary. His job is to bring certain things about mankind to the attention of God. One gets no sense of malevolence whatsoever about the work or the being of Satan in the book of Job. Therefore, to translate Satan or Hasatan as Satan in the book of Job is to cast upon it a medieval angle, a vision that it simply doesn't have. That's what I alluded to a moment ago when I said that what we tried to do with the translation was elicit from the biblical text its tonalities, its resonances, its piety, rather than put upon the biblical text the tonalities of the medieval world, for that matter, even the rabbinic world, and certainly the modern world that that text simply does not have.
Okay, thank you. If I could just ask another related thing is, by the time the New Testament came around, which was probably a span of 500 years or so, it clearly is, Satan has clearly developed into something that is a lot more evil and is actually fighting against God in many respects. Do you have any insight as to when that developed from the time of the Old Testament, or at least when Job was written, to the New Testament?
I would say that some of that has to do with some of the importations of Zoroastrianism into the Western world, the dualisms in the world, the breaking of the world radically into good and evil, the notion of hell hereafter, in which sinners were terribly punished and so on. All of that comes to us from the Persian world, and it may very well have to do with that. It may very well be that the dualism that comes to us from the Persian world took the adversary concept, which was essentially a benign concept in Judaism, and polarized it so that what you have now is God on the one hand representing good, and the Satan on the other hand representing evil and the demonic. And then this alteration occurred very early on in the medieval period.
Thanks so much for your very interesting questions.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Well, we only have a few minutes remaining in the program. I don't think we'll have time for any more phone calls, so my regrets to those of you who are waiting on the phone now. I'd really be interested in hearing how you chose which word you were going to use for God in each passage. The choices include God and Lord, Yahweh. How did you decide, and is there any way of telling from the Hebrew text?
Yes, there
as many names
there
in Hebrew?
There are different names in Hebrew. We never use Yahweh, which is a name you're not allowed to pronounce. So pardon me for pronouncing it, Lord. But I have to pronounce it for educational purposes. if a word that's spelled in a certain way, Aleph, Dalet, Nun, Yud, for example, Adonai, is translated as God. And the word that's spelled in another fashion, with a Yud and a Hey and a Vav and a Hey, is translated as Lord. And that becomes very technical and very Hebrew. But we were very careful about the names of God.
In the end of Ecclesiastes, in your translation, instead of fear God, it's revere God. And that's, I think, a very dramatic difference. And I think the notion of fearing God ties in with the notion of the jealous God. What's the nature of the mistranslation, the way you see it, from fear to revere?
The word is, if I remember correctly, yaro, and it really means to revere. The notion of fear today is someone that you're in dread of, and the biblical notion was not to be in dread of God. The biblical notion was to reverence him, to regard him with awe. This was the omnipotent one, the mighty one, the one who entered history and redirected the fate of the Israelite people and controls history and together with man controls the destiny of the cosmos. That's not the sort of being that you live in terror of, because you can't function if you're in terror of a deity of this kind. Clearly the biblical mind said to revere a deity of this kind, and that's the way it was translated in the New JPS translation.
One of our listeners called a little earlier to refer to, I think it was 1940 translation. Who uses which translation? Who's going to use the Jewish Publication Society translation? Who will use the translation that our listener referred to? And do these different committees of scholars ever meet and compare notes?
Sometimes they do, but they always read one another's published writings. And the Catholic Church, of course, has its own official translation. Various Protestant groups have their translations. And now the Jewish group has its new translation. I discovered recently that the new Jewish Publication Society translation is being very carefully looked at by seminaries all through the country, and there's no doubt in my mind that the impetus of this translation will forever affect what it is that takes place in Bible translations from here on in. It's already beginning to have a marked effect upon the whole tradition of Bible translations.
Well, I want to thank you very much for sharing some of the thinking of the committee of scholars that you were a part of that created this new translation. Chaim Potok has been my guest. He's a novelist and also a writer of nonfiction, an ordained conservative rabbi, and he was the secretary of the committee of scholars that translated the third and final volume of the Old Testament for the Jewish Publication Society. Their mission was to go back to the Hebrew text and to translate that original meaning into modern English. This new volume, the third volume, is published under the name The Writings by the Jewish Publication Society. Chaim Potok's novels include The Chosen, The Promise, My Name is Asher Lev, The Book of Lights, and also a book of nonfiction called Wanderings, A History of the Jews. And again, thanks so much for comparing the several different translations and for talking about how the decisions were made in this new translation.
Thank you, Terry.
Thanks also to our listeners who called with their questions and comments. It's a minute to five, and all things considered, it's coming up at five. First, let me tell you what's happening tomorrow on Fresh Air. WUHY station manager Bill Seemring will be with us at 2 o'clock. He joins us once a month on Fresh Air to talk about any new program schedule changes, to call our attention to special programs coming up in the month ahead. And then we open up the phones and invite you to call with any questions or comments you'd like to share with Bill about our programs. So you'll be invited to do that at 2 o'clock tomorrow afternoon. At 3 o'clock, we'll feature another in the series of Literature and the Urban Experience. At 3:30, we'll rebroadcast an interview with Dave Richards, who wrote a biography of actress Jean Seberg. And at about 4:15, we'll hear from Miss Manners, also known as Judith Martin, who writes the Washington Post syndicated column on behavior in the modern world. So that's coming up tomorrow afternoon on Fresh Air, and I hope you can join us then. If you have any questions or comments about the show, drop us a line. We're at WUHY, 150 North 6th Street, Philadelphia, 19106. Francis Davis contributed to today's show. Paul Keller was the technical director, Maeve McGoran the production assistant, and Danny Miller the associate producer. My name's Terry Gross, and I want to thank you for listening. Have a good evening. This is WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. Stay tuned for All Things Considered.
Financial support for this program is provided by the National Public Radio News and Information Fund. Contributors to this fund include the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, for historical reporting, the Pew Memorial Trust, for international news coverage, the German Marshall Fund of the United States, and for Midwestern coverage, the Joyce Foundation. This program is a production of National Public Radio, which is solely responsible for its content.
Good evening. From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Susan Stamberg.
And I'm Sanford Unger, with All Things Considered.
Graphics, and now I'm just trying to make like a figure. It took me maybe 2 days to learn just this.
It's amazing what you can do with these machines with graphics. I'm really impressed with it. And I can see after this how, you know, the arcade games do work, how Space Invaders and all that, how they do things.
The kids are the sophisticates at this computer camp. They've been pushing buttons for years. It's their parents who are new to the new wonders of electronics, microcomputers. Tonight on All Things Considered, we go to computer camp for some intergenerational programming.
Also these stories, civilians leaving West Beirut, the immigration creates problems for the PLO.
In Israel, a rally against the invasion of Lebanon.
Leaders of American Jewish organizations say the administration will not impose sanctions soon on Israel.
The nuclear freeze issue, debated in the House.
Supply-siders angry at White House support for a tax increase.
Come back, all debts forgiven.
That from the owner of a variety store in New Hampshire.
And it's the 20th anniversary of Marilyn Monroe's death. We'll talk about what she meant to men and women.
On All Things Considered, first we have news from John Hockenberry.
The United States today called on Israel not only to observe a ceasefire in Beirut, but to withdraw from the PLO-controlled western side of the city completely. Israeli tanks moved into West Beirut yesterday in the heaviest fighting of the war. The State Department would not say what the U.S. reaction would be if Israel ignores the request. Sanctions have been mentioned, but according to American Jewish leaders who met today with the Vice President and Secretary of State, sanctions are not being considered. Beirut was relatively quiet today, relative, that is, to yesterday. Lebanese security officials say 250 people were killed in yesterday's Israeli armored advance. 670 people were wounded. Israel says 19 of its troops died. Reporter Vincent Shadolsky says Israeli jets flew mock air raids over Beirut today, but there was only scattered gunfire as both Israel and the PLO dug in.
The official Beirut radio and eyewitnesses report that the Palestinians and the Israelis are consolidating and strengthening those frontline positions. and there's been no change on the ground. So basically, the Israelis are encircling West Beirut as they always have. They've moved slightly closer to the center of town in the south, but that was not that significant.
Israel Today opened up one border crossing into East Beirut, and hundreds of residents fled the western side of the city. In the Nevada desert today, the U.S. Department of Energy conducted a test of a nuclear device, and the detonation sent shockwaves rolling across the landscape, shaking buildings in Las Vegas, 70 miles away. The Energy Department says the underground test caused a cave-in 1,000 feet in diameter and deep enough to swallow a skyscraper. The explosion itself was contained underground, and officials said no radiation was released. The device was 7 times more powerful than the bomb that devastated Hiroshima 37 years ago tomorrow. The Japanese marked the eve of the disaster with marches and prayer groups in hopes of guaranteeing the error shall not be repeated, the inscription on the Hiroshima Memorial. A similar sentiment was expressed today in the House of Representatives, where supporters of a nuclear weapons freeze are trying to pass a freeze resolution over President Reagan's objections. The administration's position has been that a freeze would solidify Soviet nuclear superiority. But Democrat Clement Zablocki says that U.S. and Soviet arsenals are at a virtual parity now, and that under the resolution, the freeze would be a two-way street.
The measure says any freeze must be mutual and verifiable. In other words, there will be no freeze if it is not mutual. There will be no freeze if it is not verifiable. This resolution is most definitely not unilateral disarmament.
A vote on the resolution is expected shortly, but administration lobbying against it has assured a close vote. It still might not be built, but the Clinch River Breeder Reactor Project moved a step forward today. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission voted to begin preliminary work. The reactor is a pilot project for a controversial new energy technology, controversial because it is expensive and creates lots of weapons-grade plutonium. But NPR's Daniel Zwerdling reports that the president is solidly behind the project despite congressional opposition.
As a result of the NRC decision, the nuclear companies can bypass public hearings and begin $40 million worth of preliminary work to get ready for the breeder, clearing woods, leveling ground, building a cement plant. Top administration officials believe the Congress will be a lot more likely to fund the breeder if legislators can see that work has actually gotten off the ground. But opposition to the breeder is growing. President Reagan wants more than $500 million for the breeder program next year. And Representative Vin Weber, Republican from Minnesota, says he may not get it.
Why argue against Clinch River based on the administration's own free market principles? We're going to beat the breeder this year, in my judgment.
100 legislators signed a letter this week saying they will fight the breeder program this fall. I'm Daniel Zwerdling in Washington.
House Speaker Tip O'Neill today baited the president to come out strongly in favor of the $99 billion tax increase bill now being considered by a House-Senate conference committee. At the same time, the tax bill was strongly criticized by the supply-side conservatives who helped President Reagan get elected. Republican Congressman Jack Kemp says he can't support the new taxes despite the fact President Reagan backed the bill when it was in the Senate. Kemp says more taxes won't decrease the deficits or help speed the recovery.
So I just have been forced into opposing one temporary piece of policy that the White House believes in. But that doesn't mean I'm breaking with them or splitting with them. I'm a strong supporter of this president and think he's got the country headed in the right direction. But raising taxes is the wrong thing to do.
Kemp has been rounding up Republican opposition in the House, and Speaker O'Neill says if the president doesn't strongly endorse the tax bill, it can't pass. Today, House-Senate negotiators considered an amendment extending unemployment benefits by a few weeks, a move aimed at attracting skeptical Democrats to support the tax plan. Another big loss on Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell nearly 8 points to close at 795.85. The average price of a share on the New York Exchange lost 22 cents. I'm John Hockenberry in Washington.
Israeli tanks dug in near Palestinian camp south of Beirut today, and Israeli planes flew mock air raids over the city. Artillery exchanges were sporadic. The Israelis opened one crossing point between the two sectors of the city, and thousands of West Beirut residents took advantage of the lull in the fighting to flee to the other side. In Israel, the cabinet has been in session for several hours now, trying to determine their next step in Lebanon. Jim Letterman reports from Jerusalem.
The Israeli cabinet meeting tonight is being described by officials here alternately as critical and decisive. There's little doubt that there is great concern here over the short and possibly medium-term future of Israeli-American relations. On the cabinet agenda are at least three main items: the fighting in Beirut, the UN demand to position observers in Beirut, and the American demands for a return to the status quo which exists prior to the latest Israeli advances. The Israeli cabinet is known to be seriously divided on the latest Israeli military moves. But cabinet insiders say that Prime Minister Begin and Defense Minister Sharon continue to command the support of a majority of the ministers. The hawks are convinced that without continued pressure on the Palestinians, the PLO will not agree to leave Beirut. In a speech today, Prime Minister Begin reiterated that all the PLO fighters must leave the city. In recent remarks, Begin has made it plain that he views the Israeli campaign in Beirut as being similar to that waged by the Allies in Berlin at the end of World War II, and he regards Yasser Arafat as being the reincarnation of Hitlerism. Political insiders stated tonight that despite the differences in the cabinet, they do not believe that Israel would agree to the demands that it should withdraw. The sources also said that it was highly unlikely that Israel would agree to the positioning of UN observers between the fighting units in Beirut. Earlier today, officials here said that while Israel is concerned about the recent American position as laid out by President Reagan, Israel will not be panicked into taking decisions she does not agree with. The Israeli spokesman and radio stations today made great play of the fact that the Israeli troops in West Beirut were digging in thoroughly in the newly captured areas. They also emphasized what they claimed were the shortages of fuel in West Beirut, as well as the commanding position Israeli tanks have taken on the heights controlling the main refugee camps of Sabra, Shatila, and Borjel Barajneh. For National Public Radio, this is Jim Letterman in Jerusalem.
President Reagan and Prime Minister Begin are exchanging messages about the breakdown of the ceasefire in Lebanon. The president sent a firmly worded letter to the Israeli government, and Prime Minister Begin's reply is expected to be equally strong. NPR's Bill Buesenberg has more on the administration's attempt to keep negotiations in the Middle East on course.
The Reagan administration desperately wants a pause in the fighting so negotiations can intensify. Officials say Special Envoy Philip Habib has been making some progress in negotiating a PLO pullout. There was some officially expressed optimism that he can succeed, but he needs more time. Consequently, State Department officials said the United States has called on Israel not only to observe